Let's open up to Job chapter 3. I don't. That's all we got. Thank you, Herb. Job chapter 3 is where we want to start. We're going to do just a little bit of review. We've got some people in here that were not in our initial 3-month study on the resurrection. And again, if you're confused as to why we're not studying the family, Steve's out of town and he asked me to complete my last 2 classes in his absence that we didn't get to cover because of Harvey. When we started this study, we were looking at the 3 mountaintops of faith, historical events that our faith is built upon. If you can think back that far, and you don't have too many cobwebs if you have to dust out of your memory, which one was the first of the 3? Creation. Right. And from the creation, we learn what? That there is a God. What's the second event? Exodus. And from the Exodus, we learn what? Yeah, who is that God? Jehovah. He is the ruler of the universe. Now, the one that we focused on was the resurrection. And what does the resurrection reveal to the history student? He existed, but more than that, he came back from the dead, yes. But what does that tell me about who he is? Son of God. That's right. Jesus is the Son of God. In the New Testament, we have 4 events that are presented as the kernel of the gospel. Okay? You remember those? The first one, I'll help you out, is that Jesus died. And there's a corresponding fact that proves that he died. He was buried. Right. He died and he was buried. And then the tomb was found empty. He arose. What supports the fact that he arose? He appeared. Right. Right, people saw him. From there, we looked at the integrity of the manuscripts that we have that make up our New Testament. We talked about how old they are. We talked about who wrote them, how they agree with one another. And we talked about how accurate they were in terms of transmission down through the ages and testing them by secular history. And then we wrapped all that up by looking at 5 facts that even skeptics have to admit to as being true with regard to the gospel story of Jesus. The first of which is something that Alex said a minute ago. Jesus actually lived and he died on the cross. The second is that his disciples believed that they saw him after he died. The conversion of the persecutor Paul and James, the skeptical brother of the Lord. And then the last one that Keith mentioned a second ago. Without a doubt, the tomb was found empty. And when we put all these together, we see that there is a solid case, as you could hope to find, for the resurrection of Jesus. Now, if Jesus is raised from the dead, that means that the Bible is inspired. He believed that to be the case, and he taught that to be the case. And if he's raised from the dead, we can trust every single word that we find within the pages of the book. So that leads us to what we're going to talk about today. Before we got hit by the storm, we were looking at 3 general stumbling blocks to faith, the first of which was the theory of evolution. Now, just last week, I was in Nacogdoches, and I heard Buddy Payne talk about the scientific case for design. It was a really good talk. But if Jesus is raised for the dead, do you even have to be aware of the scientific case for design? No. Because he believed in the Genesis story of creation, right? If he's raised from the dead, Genesis 1 and 2 are true. The other stumbling block that we looked at was the fact that we live in a modern-day pagan world. That's one of the questions that people raise. If there is one God, why are there so many religions? And we talked about how in Acts 17, the resurrection and the creation helps us respond to that challenge. Today we look at what is probably the greatest challenge, not just to Christianity, but probably to every religion. Why do bad things happen to good people? Look in Job chapter 3, verses 11 and 12. Somebody tell me what kind of man Job was when he began to suffer. Was he a bad man? Good man? Not just a good man, how good was he? Very righteous. Would you say he was the best man of his age? That's pretty much what the prologue of the book tells us. In chapters 1 and 2, though, some terrible sufferings are inflicted upon this good man. And initially, when his sufferings began, we read that he did not curse God, didn't say much of anything, just sort of took it all in tremendous stride. But in chapter 3, verses 11 and 12, Job says, why? That's one of the biggest words in the book. It comes up again and again. Why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me, and why the breasts that I should suck? In other words, why wasn't I stillborn? It would have been better for me to have died as an infant than to have never grown up and experienced this. We drop down to verse 23. Job says, why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? The devil went to God and said, the only reason Job serves you is because you've hedged him in. And what the devil meant by that was, you've bought him off. He's got a great life. You take that life away from him, he'll curse you and die. In verse 23, when Job mentions being hedged in, it's a different idea, it seems to be. He's not looking at God as his protector, but God as his afflictor. And this may be the beginning of when he started to blame God for his suffering. Look at chapter 7. Verses 20 and 21. If there's any doubt that eventually Job begins to blame God, this should settle the issue. Chapter 7 and verse 20. Speaking to God, have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? Why have you killed all 10 of my children? Why have you given me boils head to toe? Jehovah, why have you done all of this? Look at chapter 9 and verse 29. Job thought if you lived a good life, a righteous life, then you ought to expect a life free of pain and suffering. If you lived an unrighteous life, then you ought to expect to go through the things that he's going through. So in chapter 9 and verse 29, he says, I am accounted wicked. Why then should I toil in vain? In other words, what has all this been about? I've been serving you faithfully, and now all this has happened to me. What was the point? I should have just lived any way I wanted to, since you were still going to treat me this way. When you get to chapter 21, in verse 7, you see the other side of the coin raised. On the one hand, all of us, whether you're reading the book of Job or you're just looking at life experience, we may be faced with this question. Why do bad things happen to good people? But there's a flip side to that. Not just why do bad things happen to good people, but why do good things happen to bad people? This is what Job raises in chapter 21 and verse 7. Why do the wicked still live, continue on, also become very powerful? And he goes on throughout this speech to raise that question. Why do good things happen to bad people? Look at Psalm 73. The flip side of the coin is again entertained in Psalm 73. In Psalm 73 and verse 1, the psalmist makes a declaration of faith in God's goodness. Surely God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet came close to stumbling. My steps had almost slipped. What does he mean? He just made a declaration of faith and confidence in verse 1. What he means is, I almost came to the point where I stopped believing that. Why did you almost stop believing that? Verse 3. For I was envious of the arrogant as I saw the prosperity of the wicked. There are no pains in their death, and their body is fat. They are not in trouble as other men, nor are they plagued like mankind. Therefore, pride is their necklace. The garment of violence covers them. And on and on and on he goes. They get off scot-free. These are vexing questions that have troubled man almost since the beginning. This is probably the biggest challenge to Christianity. I think it's the biggest challenge to any religion, no matter what your faith system is. But especially for us, because we claim that not only is there a God, we claim He's a good God. John 3:16, God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. So then, if there is this all-powerful good God, how could there possibly be all this evil and pain in the world? Why is it that an unrighteous man gets to swindle people out of millions of dollars, and he gets to live a good life, has a great family, and then you meet people that are righteous and they try to live for the Lord, and maybe they wind up having to bury their child that just died of horrible cancer. Why is that? What the skeptic would argue is evil exists. Anybody want to challenge that this morning, or do we agree with that? That's one of the things about this argument, first of all, is very rational. But the second thing about the argument that is very convincing for a lot of people is it's very personal. Any number of us, probably all of us, could list at least one case where we looked at the way things turned out for somebody and we said, that's just not fair. That's not right. Bad things happen to good people, and a good God would do something about it. Do you agree with that statement? A good God would do something about it? I agree with it. I tell you what, if there is a good God and He's not doing something about it, I don't know that I would want to serve Him. I agree with that. But the skeptic says, so then, why doesn't He? They argue that He doesn't because He's not there. Rocky? Right. Right, right. So especially if you believe in the God that's revealed to us, that not only is He a good God, but He's a God of justice, who exacts vengeance upon wrongdoing, then yes, He must do something about it. And Rocky's hit the nail on the head. The question is it a matter of if or simply when? So some observations about this. Let's say you're talking to somebody and they make this argument. First of all, if they make this argument to you, this does not magically make all the evidence for the resurrection disappear. And that's one of the things that I think people are quick to forget. This is such a troubling argument, one for which I don't think there are any easy answers in most cases for specific instances that people are looking for. But that does not mean that everything we talked about 3 months of our study is just gone. And that's the first thing that we have to remember. But let's say that somebody wants to just talk about this and they're not even yet to sitting down and looking at the evidence for Jesus. One of my first questions is, if you say that there is no God, if say you're like C.S. Lewis, you're 10 years old, your mother dies of cancer, and then you get shipped off to a boarding school in England and everybody that's running it is a tyrant, and you declare at a very young age there is no God, because if there is a God, how could there possibly be all this pain and suffering in my life? How could things have worked out so terribly for me and the people I love? My first question is, if there is no God, then how do you even know what is fair and what is unfair? If there is no God, how do you know what good and evil are? Do you know what good and evil are? If there was not someone who from the beginning set forth a law for man to abide by and instilled within each one of us a conscience by which we could gauge not only our own actions, but everybody else's, and just the way the dice fall? How can you be so confident there is no creator? You have just told me that there is a universal standard of right and wrong. Without that standard, you are in no position to say that this thing in life is fair or this thing in life is unfair. So by their own argument, by their own challenge, they leave the door open for the existence of God. You see the argument there? If you say that there are things in life by which we can all agree something is fair or not fair, you've just indicated there is a universal standard, and that points to a lawgiver above all of us.
I think they would try to argue that we, you know, have evolved to have conscience and morals and things like that, but that goes against everything that nature tells us.
Right.
The animals don't, you know, consciously show things like love or things that are good, you know what I'm saying?
Right, right. Right. Yeah. I forget which poet it was, but nature red in tooth and claw. That's not what you see in man, unless it's Yankees fans. But you just don't find that with us, because we are imprinted with God's image and everything that comes with that, not just our soul, but our conscience and everything else. All right, let's look in the Bible just for a second. Look in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. The question is a big question. Why do bad things happen to good people? It's a question for which the Bible will give us many general causes that could sufficiently answer that question in general. And I'm stressing in general because when it gets to specifics, I think that's where we all have to admit that we may not have the answers we would like to have. Look at Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 29. As the writer of Ecclesiastes, Solomon, he contemplates why there is so much evil in the world, and then he reaches his conclusion in chapter 7 and verse 29. Behold, I have found only this, that God made men upright, but they have sought out many devices. On the one hand, we could talk about the parent that has to bury their child because of an illness. On the other, we could talk about the parent that has to bury their child because they were murdered. And one reason why there is so much pain and suffering in this world is because of what we might call moral evil. That's different from natural evil, the evil of a flood or an illness. Moral evil is sometimes referred to as man's inhumanity to man. And why is it that there is so much wickedness? Man has free will, and sometimes he doesn't make the best of choices with the free moral agency that God has endowed him with. So this would be our first general answer to the problem, but not an entirely sufficient one. And the Bible gives us some other things to contemplate as well. Look in Genesis 3. What consequences do we suffer? This may not be a good question, but maybe you'll see where I'm going with it. What consequences do we suffer for our own sins? What are the major consequence that each one of us suffers for our own sin? Separation from God, spiritual death. Do we suffer any consequences because of Adam and Eve's sin? Yes, we do. Yeah. Now, this is one thing that a lot of people in the Christian world, if you want to call it that, get wrong. A lot of people think that the consequence we suffer for Adam and Eve's sin is spiritual death. That's not true. Consequences are spelled out for us in Genesis 3 and verse 16. To the woman, he says, I will multiply your pain in childbirth. When we talk about the consequences of Adam and Eve's sin, one of the things that we emphasize over and over is physical death, and that's true. That comes up later. But don't forget what he tells the woman in verse 16. Don't forget what he tells the man at first in verse 17. One of the consequences is pain. Pain. Verse 17, cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall grow for you. Verse 19, by the sweat of your face you will eat bread. It's not going to be fun having to work to provide for yourself. And then he says, till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. When people look at the curse of death that we labor under and we are plagued with, it just screams out to us, this is so wrong. Think of the heartache and the tears that you shed when you have to say goodbye to your loved one. Question, is that the way that man was intended to live? No. No. It's perfectly natural for us to say, this isn't right. That's not the way it was meant to be. But nonetheless, it is reality and we have to accept it. So, in verse 19, we see that not only do we suffer pain because of what Adam and Eve did, but also death. Every one of us is dead already, if you want to think of it that way, unless the Lord comes back. It is finality, and the rest is just details. That's why we all need to be prepared for it. And thanks be to God that there is a remedy for it. Look in Ecclesiastes 9. Why do bad things happen to good people? Some general answers. One, people are just wicked to each other and make bad choices. Two, we all suffer the fallout of what happened in the garden. And three, sometimes there really is no answer. Sometimes it's just one of those things that happen. I used to believe that everything happened for a reason. I don't believe that anymore, and the Bible does not teach that. In Ecclesiastes 9, verses 11 and 12, the author is again talking about the problem of death. He mentions that death is the most indiscriminate thing you will ever run into. It doesn't care if you're rich or poor. Doesn't care if you are good or bad. It's coming. And he talks about some of the causes of it. Chapter 9 and verse 11, I again saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors, and neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability. For time and chance overtake them all. Moreover, man does not know his time. Like fish caught in a treacherous net and birds trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared in an evil time when it suddenly falls on them. You would think, going back to verse 11, that the battle is to the warriors. Surely, if anyone will survive the battle, if anyone will get through life, it's going to be the man who is prepped for it. Men like Chris Kyle, American sniper, goes overseas, claims over 100 scalps against the enemy, comes back home and goes to a shooting range with a man with a PTSD and winds up dead. Make sense of that. Dr. Atkins, people are familiar with him, took good care of himself, helped a lot of other people get well, and he slips and falls on a patch of ice and dies. Time and chance. What's the meaning behind it all? Maybe there is no grand meaning, and maybe it's just one of those things that's the roll of the dice, and there is no grand plan behind it. Look at Genesis 50. Yeah. Right. 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 So, good thought. Physical people in a physical world, physical things will happen to us. This is in contrast to what you read in Genesis 50 and verse 20. Sometimes there is no grand plan behind it all. It's just one of those things that happens. The wind blew the right way and it cooked up a hurricane in the ocean and then it made landfall. Just one of those things. Sometimes, though, there is something behind it all. In Genesis 50, Jacob is dead, and Joseph's brothers are starting to panic. Daddy's gone. He might finally take everything out on us that we have coming. So they go to him in verse 18, and they say, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them in verse 19, "Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place?" When you look at his response in verses 19 and 20, as to why he does not exact vengeance upon them for the way they cruelly sold him into slavery. He pleaded with them to get out of that pit. They turned a deaf ear. He says, first of all, in verse 19, it's not right. I'm in no position to make that call. But second, as for you, verse 20, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. I don't know why it had to be that way. I don't even think it had to be that way for God to fulfill his plan to preserve Abraham's seed for the Messiah. But that's the way it worked. And sometimes what God does is he takes very bad things and uses them to bring about very good things. And it may be that one reason why good people suffer is because, if you want to think of it this way, right now they're the pawn on the chessboard. And God is using them to bring about some great result. You see this throughout the Bible. You could take the words of Joseph in verse 20, you could put them in the mouth of Jesus, and you could have him saying that to the Pharisees. It would be just as true. Why do bad things happen to good people? Sometimes that's God's plan. Sometimes that's the way he serves his people. Sometimes that's the way he keeps his promises. Sometimes that's the way he brings about blessings for other people. It was worth Joseph going through all that so that he could wind up in a position to save his family and his nation. Look in Job chapter 1. Sometimes it's not God's plan. Sometimes it's just the devil's spitefulness. Sometimes he's making a wager with God, and God lets him inflict whatever pain and suffering he wants to in order to show that Satan does not know people as well as he thinks he does. Job 1 and verse 6, Satan shows up among the sons of God. Verse 7, God says, "Where you been?" Satan indicates what Peter says about him. He's been a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. Then in verse 8, God says, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." That sets the stage for what happens to Job. So why is it that Job suffered? Well, because God was bragging about him. Why did Job endure what he endured? Because God was proud of him. Satan is the consummate cynic in verse 9. Does Job fear God for nothing? He doesn't believe the best about anyone. It says in verse 10, "You've made a hedge around him and all that he has. You've blessed the work of his hands. Of course he serves you. You've bought him off." But verse 11, "Put forth your hand now, touch all that he has. He will curse you to your face." So the Lord said, "All that he has is in your power. Do not put forth your hand on him." You remember what Jesus told Peter? Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat. Why do bad things happen to good people? Maybe there is this wager going on between the devil and God, and we don't know about it. When you read through the book of Job, is there ever any indication that Job finds out about what happened between God and Satan? Not at all. The reader knows why he went through what he went through. As far as we know, Job never found out. Boy, that's relatable. Maybe that's what's going on. Maybe there's something behind the curtain. Look at chapter 42. I don't have this one on the handout, but it's worth mentioning nonetheless. In chapter 42, this is the conclusion of Job's sufferings. The so what behind it all is coming to a head. Job did not suffer because he sinned. However, because he suffered, he did sin. He sat in judgment of God and basically said that he had more integrity than God had. God was treating him unfairly to let all this happen. So then God finally challenges Job with some questions about the natural world. Can Job answer any of those questions? Yeah, suddenly he has to swallow his pride and admit he doesn't know nearly as much about God as he thinks he does. So in chapter 42 and verse 6, "Therefore I retract and I," what? "Repent." That means he's guilty of something. Wasn't guilty of something when his suffering started, but somewhere along the way he became guilty of something. And this was not simply about God wanting to prove the devil wrong about Job and his integrity, but Job also needed to learn some things. And sometimes bad things happen to good people because we need to be corrected. And that's what happened with Job. He needed to be corrected in his thinking and realize he didn't have it all figured out like he thought he did. On the next page of the lesson, at the top, just briefly allude to this one. We won't read it. Genesis 18, this is when God is speaking to Abraham, and he indicates that he will destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham seems to know some things about that city. He knows they're pretty wicked. And you remember what Abraham keeps asking God over and over? "If you find X amount of people, will you destroy the city? Will you wipe out the righteous with the wicked?" And he just keeps going down, 50 all the way down to 10. Now, the question obviously implies that it's God's right, if he wants to yes, just press the button and wipe out everyone indiscriminately. And obviously, if there were not more than 10 people, he was going to wipe out both those cities. And had Lot not been warned, he'd have been wiped out with the rest of them. Sometimes bad things happen to good people because of God's righteous judgments on the wicked. Now, these are all general causes that might explain why people suffer. But I think a lot of times when people ask, why do bad things happen to good people, what they really want to know is, why is this happening to me or my loved one? And the thing about all these answers that we've looked at is they've come from the mind and the mouth of prophets. How many prophets do we have today? It's pretty hard for me to be able to look at one particular case and say whether or not a wager was made with God or man, or if this person has something they need to learn and be corrected, or what. When we are faced with specifics, a lot of us need to have the humility to say simply, I don't know. I don't know why this is happening to that person. Yeah. Right. Look at Job chapter 4. Keith's answer is good. I may not know why bad things happen to good people, but do I know there's a God? How do you know it? First mountaintop. Creation. Is Jesus the Son of God? How do you know it? Resurrection. In Job 4, in verses 7 and 8, Job's friends think they have it all figured out. They think they've got a reason, thinking of Job, as to why this is happening. Job is told in verse 7, remember now, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright destroyed? I tell you what, if that's true, the gospel story is a lie. It is a lie. According to what I have seen, those who plow iniquity and those who sow trouble harvest it. That may be true in a lot of cases. If you live a bad life, you'll get your comeuppance. But it's not true in every case. The psalmist said, my feet came close to stumbling. Because a lot of times wicked people get off scot-free. These men make the mistake of putting their faith in what they don't know. They think they know it, but they don't know it. The story of Job proves that they are wrong. The story of Jesus proves they are wrong. Look in John chapter 9. People think they know how the world should work and why things are the way they are when it comes to suffering, but in fact they don't. In Job chapter 9, in verse 2, after seeing a man blind from birth, his disciples asked, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind? Jesus said in verse 3, it was neither that this man sinned or his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him. They're talking to a man in verse 3 that has some inside knowledge beyond this world. And he can tell them, you're wrong. You guys need to realize that you don't have it all figured out like you think you do. Boy, what a lesson that is for us when we're confronted with the problem of suffering. Job had to admit his ignorance, and we do as well. Look in 1 Corinthians 15. I could give you the names of people, friends that I've buried. Why did they die the way they did? I don't know the answer to that. But I know there's an empty tomb in Jerusalem, and I know why. And my knowledge about that event trumps my ignorance over others. I'll put my faith on that, in that, and not in the things that I can't explain. We need to remind ourselves about this. Not what we don't know, but what does the Christian know? He knows Jesus is the Son of God. He knows that because of the resurrection. And I think that the Christian would agree, like we said earlier, yes, a good, powerful God, He would do something about the problem of pain and suffering. Yes, He would. Has He? Yes, He has. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 54, as Paul looks toward the resurrection of all men that will come about when Christ returns, he says, when this perishable will have put on the imperishable and this mortal will have put on immortality, then will come about the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? If you don't have faith in Jesus, in verse 55, those questions are not questions that invite triumph. They invite defeat. You look around, you say, their victory is everywhere. But the Christian knows in verse 56, the sting of death is sin. That's what's so bad about dying. You die and you face God in judgment for your sins. And the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Not only do we not have to fear death, we don't have to fear death and then facing God in judgment because of Jesus. Praise God for that. Look in Hebrews 2. Hebrews 2 and verse 14, this book was written to an audience of Christians that were being persecuted for their faith. The author tells them, you haven't shed blood yet, so they weren't being persecuted to death yet, but they had faced the seizure of their property and jail time, and they were facing significant pressure to return to the law of Moses. In chapter 2 and verse 14, therefore, since the children share in flesh and blood, he himself, Jesus, likewise also partook of the same, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and might free those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. If you fear death, if you fear the power of death that the rulers of their time could wield, then you were a slave. They could force you to give up your faith in Jesus and go back to the law of Moses, whereby you would give up your soul. But if you are convinced of the power of Jesus, having broken death, and that we likewise will share in that same victory, the devil has no power over you. It doesn't matter what you're faced with or what the threats are. You won't be afraid. People might look at verses 14 and 15 and say, yeah, but people are still dying. And they are. But did Jesus stay dead? There will come a time when those in the graves will not stay dead. That is the time that gives us our triumphant victory that we look forward to anxiously and we need to live by every day. I don't know why bad things happen to good people in every specific case. You don't either. But I know that the resurrection is true. I know Jesus is the Son of God. And if it is true, it takes this big question for which we may not have an easy answer. Why do bad things happen to good people? And it completely reframes it. I don't need to make that the most important question in life. The most important question is, why did the worst thing imaginable happen to the best man that ever lived? It happened because I need forgiveness. It happened because we need victory over the grave. And with Jesus on the cross and the empty tomb, we have that. All right, we're out of time. Thank you for your comments and your attention this morning. I don't have a lesson handout for Wednesday night. The plan is for us to look over 1 Corinthians 15. If you want to read and study that before Wednesday, that's what we'll be doing when we meet again.